This is Beyond Abuse Radio, a safe place to find healing and embrace your beauty. And now, your executive producer and host, life coach, and spiritual director, Misa Leonessa.
Hello, and welcome to Beyond Abuse Radio. I'm so glad that you've joined us today, and I am excited about the things that we're going to be talking about and the guests I'm going to be introducing in a little bit. But before we jump into that, I just want you to know that healing from trauma isn't easy, and I'm sure that's something that you have already figured out, and that's why you're here. But I also want you to know that you're not alone in that process. Healing isn't easy, but healing is possible. And the good news is that there are plenty of people to walk alongside you in that process. Beyond Abuse Radio brings you information and inspiration, encouragement and support to help you be able to walk through that journey of transforming your trauma into healing, into actual beauty. And Beyond Abuse provides a safe place for you to heal and to help you embrace all the parts of yourself and be able to see that really you are very beautiful. Good job in being here and in knowing that you are taking some time out to take care of yourself, to get the resources that you need. And I know that not everybody who struggles with sugar has a trauma background, and some of you are listening that maybe can't relate to the trauma part of it. We've been doing a whole series on addiction and healing addiction, and there is a whole lot of overlap between experiencing trauma and dealing with addictive behaviors. And this is our ninth show on the issue, and you might want to take a look at the archives, because if you struggle or know anybody else who struggles with any number of other kinds of addictions, we've talked an awful lot about all kinds of great topics that would be helpful for you or to share with those that you love that really, really can be life-changing. At the beginning of each show, I like to start with a gratefulness moment, so let's just pause for a minute and think about what you are grateful for today. Today, I am grateful for being able to talk to my husband, who is in Shanghai, China. Amazing. We have cell phones that can connect that far. He's having a really great, interesting cross-cultural experience. And as I hold the place down here and defend the fort while he's gone, it was just really neat to be able to connect with each other. So I wonder what you're grateful for today. If you'd like to share it, you can join us in the chat room on Blog Talk Radio, or you can even call in. We'd love to hear from you. 323-443-7467 will get you onto the switchboard, and I can bring you on the line. Pat and I, our guests tonight, are going to be talking about kicking the sugar habit. And if you'd like to chime in with questions, you can call in. We're also going to be having a discussion from 8:30 to 9. And so you can either call in while we're talking, or you can call in at 8:30 when Tara Magbuseo is going to be joining us as well. A great discussion we're going to have tonight, and really welcome you to be part of that. Quick announcement that we have, I don't know if any of you have heard of 1 Billion Rising. It is an international campaign to raise awareness about violence against women and girls. And each year on February 14th, yes, that is Valentine's Day, people from over 200 countries all over the globe join in events to raise awareness about the issues of sexual assault that affects 1 in 3 women globally. And that's about 1 billion women. And so this year, the theme is revolution, and Santa Cruz is actually going to be talking about a revolution to find a solution. And part of that solution is involving men in this issue. This isn't just a women's issue. Lots of men also experience sexual violence, but we also need men to help stop the sexual violence against women. There are women who perpetrate sexual violence. It's not just about men who are the violators. But our focus this year is to add men's voices to the movement. And this really is not just a women's issue. It really isn't everybody's issue. And so we're going to be meeting on the 14th downtown Santa Cruz, and many, many, many local communities all over the globe will be sharing in that. We're bringing in local community organizations with booths to share information to educate the community about services and programs, and Beyond Abuse Radio will be there represented. Also offer assistance to survivors. We have all kinds of sponsors, Pacific Cookie Company, Buttercup Cakes, Bluestone Imports, Verve, KZSC, and The Wired Woman, and appreciate their help as well. So come on down. We're going to have a little walk with our signs and dancing and celebrating, and going to have some great speakers, and I hope to see you there. Addiction. We've been talking about addiction for some time, and there are studies too numerous to name that conclude that without a doubt, those who are abused as children often come to abuse substances, food, and even other people, even relationships. Addiction actually also contributes to the abuse cycle too. Not only do people in pain use and abuse drugs, both illegal and legal, and alcohol, but also food and even sugar. In fact, the sugar addiction is very closely related to alcoholism. Most people who are addicted to alcohol, if not all, are also addicted to sugar. And they find that when they stop drinking, they end up gravitating towards the sugar addiction, which keeps kind of fueling their addiction. We also have talked about sex addiction. We're going to talk more about that coming up, too. And anything else that people can find to numb the horrible feelings that are left by the wounds of child abuse. And we've been focusing on the abuse leads to addiction, and how healing addictions actually intersects with the process of healing from abuse. But the good news is that there are so many resources out there to help the addicted person, to help people heal from trauma. And we're learning how to confront the truth of the experiences behind the pain that is being self-medicated. So the issue of sugar addiction is one that is unfortunately too near and dear to my heart. It's one that I struggle with. And I just want to give you a picture here. Picture, you know, maybe you've struggled with cocaine, or you know somebody who has, and you know how hard it is to get off cocaine. And once you do, man, I mean, what you have to do is you have to just stay away from this stuff. You have to get a whole new set of friends. You've got to avoid certain parts of town. You just go way out of the way to try not to interface with it anymore. Well, what would happen if every time someone who stopped using cocaine went into their local grocery store and aisles of that store were just loaded with all different forms of bright and colorfully packaged cocaine? Okay, well, so maybe they can avoid those aisles, right? Don't go down the cocaine aisles. But then they get up to the front, and then the way that the store is set up, you have to walk all the way through this aisle. Have you noticed that lately? More and more stores are doing that, where they put products, they just load products all over, and you have to walk through this little menagerie to get up to the checkout counter. Well, what if they took the cocaine and they put it right there in front of you, and you had to stand there, and you had to look at it for 15 minutes every time you went to the checkout counter to buy food? Well, that's what we're doing, people. That's what's happening with this sugar addiction here. Is we talk about the problem of diabetes. We talk about the problem of obesity. We talk about there are so many ways that sugar affects our bodies, our minds, our spirits, and it's a big problem. The government's talking about it constantly, how to get a handle on this. And yet, every time we turn around, we're doing everything we can to set someone up to fail. And I'm especially sensitive to this because I've been trying to be off sugar for many, many years and doing it more successfully for the last 3 years, though it's still not easy. To stay 100% off sugar is really, really tough. I'm to the point where I don't crave it anymore. I don't even like it. But you know, I went through this. I was at the local drugstore the other day, and I had to go through this aisle of all this sugary junk just in front of my face, and there was no way for me to avoid it. So I called the manager, and I talked to him, and I said, saying we want to help people to become healthy. And in fact, CVS has done this great thing. I think it's been a really good PR thing for them too, where they stopped carrying cigarettes. Because if we're going to say that we are peripheral health, that we want to help people live healthier lifestyles, then maybe we shouldn't sell them cigarettes. That's a great idea, except that we're going to put sugar right in front of them every time they walk in our store in ways that they cannot even avoid it. And I said to the manager, I am trying to deal with my own sugar addiction, and it's bad enough that every holiday, I mean, think of every holiday. Valentine's Day is coming up, right? So every holiday we have different kinds of goodies. What about New Year's? What about Christmas? What about Thanksgiving? 4th of July? Every holiday we can name. You got the apple pie. We've got the pumpkin pie. We've got the chocolates. And it's so much part of everything that we do in our culture and everything we celebrate. How are we rewarded? It starts with the little girl on the potty chair, and every time she goes potty, she gets an M&M. Or having that special meal together, and it always ending with some kind of an elaborate dessert. I remember when I was 12 years old in junior high school, the big thing is we had our freedom, and we could walk next door before or after school and go to the local 7-Eleven. And boy, we all just loaded up our backpacks with candy bars and cookies, and our parents couldn't find it because we had this newfound independence. Really was a big time that my sugar addiction really increased. Now, some of you have been raised in families that eat healthy, and that's awesome. But I think a lot of people are raised in families that live on Twinkies and Hostess Ho-Hos. The other thing that Pat, I'm sure, is going to share more with you about is that it's not just the sugar-laden food. It's actually all of the carbs we eat are also converted into sugar. I could go on forever, and Pat knows a lot more about this. I just have my own experience, and I could rant and rave on and on. But I'll tell you, this woman, Patricia Adams, who is a nutritionist and doctor of naturopathy, believes that you can change your eating, and that in doing so, you will change your life. She knows both from personal experience and from her training and working with other people that eating healthy foods actually creates a healthy person. What a concept, huh? She's trained in clinical nutrition from the University of Natural Medicine and received her doctorate from Clayton College of Natural Health. She began selling supplements in 1975, earlier than some of you were born, and has worked with hundreds of clients with a broad range of symptoms and diseases, and she's watched many recover in absolute miraculous ways. Pat believes that all disease comes from underlying body imbalances, and she says that our bodies can be trusted to heal themselves with proper nutrition and in the absence of toxins. So, Pat, thank you so much for joining us today. I so appreciate you being here. And what a topic we're covering today.
Yeah, I'm so
Pat,
happy to be here with you.
Thanks so much. What exactly is this sugar addiction thing? Can we really get addicted to sugar, or is this just like some kind of silliness?
You know, it gets a lot of press, and so people start to think that it's not real, that perhaps we're not, that maybe we're making it up. But it's like any other addiction, or any behavior that we repeat habitually, regardless of whether it's harming us. It could be alcohol, it could be drugs, food, relationships. But with sugar, it's both a physical addiction and an emotional addiction. It's truly a socially acceptable addiction. If you watch any potluck with people you respect, maybe you're at a professional conference. I've been to many nutrition conferences where there's an obscene loaded up dessert table with lines heading up to it. We've all been to church potlucks where we respect and admire people, and there they are. Like you say, it's not just sugar. Their plate is loaded with white noodles and four pieces of white bread, and then when they hit the dessert table, it's not just a piece of pie, it's a piece of everything on the table. Because it's so socially acceptable, I think a lot of people I think they exchange their addictions. You know, I used to own a club in Santa Cruz, and when we closed the club down, it turned into an AA center. I don't know if I should even say this on the radio, but we used to laugh about that and say, same group 6 months later, and they'd have all the donuts and the coffee and the cigarettes. They'd just exchange one addiction for another.
Mm.
Yeah.
So not only do we eat too much of sugar and we like it because it does certain things in our brain, but it becomes almost impossible to stop.
It does become impossible to stop. Now, there's a little area of your brain called the nucleus accumbens, and that's the area that's affected by cocaine and heroin. When they do the studies on people with sugar, it lights up the nucleus accumbens just like if they did a hit of heroin or cocaine. We had a friend, well, actually a client, who was a heroin addict, and when he would start to come down and go through withdrawals, he could actually postpone the withdrawals by eating Hostess pies. That was enough to give him the same kind of fix with enough gluten and sugar that he could postpone the amount of time that before he could get his next fix. That's incredible. That a food that we might actually put into our child's lunchbox could give a heroin addict a fix.
Wow, that's pretty powerful stuff.
It really is.
What exactly is a sugar addiction, Pat?
Well, it's where your body gets used to, and probably most addictions start in the same place, in the brain. So the brain gets used to having that hit of sugar, and the brain doesn't really want to live on sugar. The brain really prefers to live on protein and fat. So, you know, later on we might talk about a good program to get people off the sugar, but if you will give the brain what it needs, and this is the recurring theme in all the consultations I do, if you will give the brain what it needs, which is lots of protein and fat, starting right out the gate first thing in the morning, then it doesn't necessarily crave its second favorite food, which is glucose. So, like you were saying, you can't avoid sugar. It's everywhere. It's on the billboards.
Yeah.
It's in the aisles of the grocery store. They have now family-friendly aisles where you can avoid the half-naked women on the magazines, but you cannot find a Snicker-free checkout stand. It's not going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And the food manufacturers well know this. And they're counting on you being hungry. So if you set yourself up and you go into a place where these foods are available and you haven't fed your brain, your brain is going to want the second favorite fuel.
What kind of things does sugar do to the brain?
Well, it causes the fuel to explode and then to crash. We've all had that sugar coma where we got that nice high, and you can watch any party at schools. You come in to pick your kids up on Valentine's Day, and the kids are running wild in the playground, just screaming their heads off, running crazy because they've had the Valentine's party with all the Valentine's candy. And then about 2 hours later, they're in their room crying because they can't figure out their homework and just emotionally have crashed. So this is what's happening. In the brain, the fuel has gone way too high, and then the pancreas has had an alarm that says, I had better make a whole lot of insulin, and then that crashes the sugar down, and that's where you get the sugar crash. And if you repeat that cycle enough times, that's what sets people up for diabetes. They get that high sugar, and then the insulin response, crash the sugar down. Then the first thing you crave is because now your sugar's a little too low. So think about that. Low blood sugar is when you had too many sugars or carbs at your last meal. So the sugar's now too low because the pancreas had to make all that insulin. And the first thing you crave is more sugar. So it's kind of a self-serving cycle.
Yeah, just kind of feeds itself, kind of a vicious cycle. So when you put that sugar in you and it starts doing all this stuff with your your blood sugar levels in your brain, and what kind of impact does that have on our bodies?
Well, the body, all the communication happens at the cellular level. So you have the little cell membranes. Everybody remembers from the high school biology, every cell has a little lipid membrane. Now, that lipid membrane is made of lipids, which are fats. We've become a very fat-phobic society, so people are afraid to eat fat, but they'll eat lots and lots of sugar. So these little lipid membranes will kind of swim up to one another and send a little messenger. There are so many chemical messengers in the body. They're called hormones. We tend to think of hormones as just the sex hormones, but there are so many hormones in the body. The cell membrane sending a hormone to the other cell, and then the other cell takes up the hormone, and it creates a change. In the case of insulin, insulin is actually a hormone. It goes to the other cell, the cell uptakes it, and it makes a change. Now the cell has fuel, and it can make ATP, and you live another day. But what if the insulin stays high all the time? Pretty soon the cell says, no, I don't want any more of that. No, I don't want any more of that. So now you have insulin resistance, and that's the pre-diabetes.
So it's kind of like being overstimulated, and then the body just eventually quits responding to it at all.
That's exactly right. And then the body makes more, the pancreas has to make more and more insulin because the cells are resistant. And then pretty soon the pancreas just can't keep up. Because almost always people don't realize that they're in that condition. They don't realize they're already there. But if you're tired after a meal, if you are weak and shaky between meals, you're already in a position where you need to really be balancing your blood sugar with good protein and fat, and you need to be having regular meals and snacks. So, you know, when people hear they have to get off the sugar and carbs, it's not their happy place. But when you tell them they get to eat, when you tell them they get to eat six times a day, and you allow them to have bacon and butter, then well, they're a little bit happier about that.
So it's not something that we haven't really talked much about, and I don't want to go off into this too much, but it's not just that we're wrong in treating the way that the medical treatment for instance, heart disease talks about avoiding fat and salt religiously and yet allows people to just, you know, go crazy with the sugar and the carbs. You've also said that there are good fats and there are bad fats, and you just mentioned butter and bacon, and on most standard diets, you know, that would be the first thing to go, right? Is all of those fatty things. Tell us a little bit about what good fats look like.
Well, if you think of a pyramid, like we're all familiar with the old food pyramid, which turned out to be wrong. but there is a fat pyramid also. So imaginarily draw with me, if you will, a big pyramid. And at the top of that pyramid is number one. In the middle section of the pyramid is the number four. And in the bottom section is the number six. So in the top part of that pyramid, the number one represents the kind of fat that's known as omega-3 or fish oil. People are pretty familiar with this. So you need 1 tablespoon a day of fish oil. That center section that is four, you need 4 tablespoons a day of a blend of nuts and seeds, olive oil, and avocado, and you're going to get your omega-6s and your omega-9s that way. Mm. The bottom section where there's a big six tablespoons a day, you need 6 tablespoons of lard, butter, and coconut oil. Mm. Now, I do qualify that. I do say that lard needs to come from animals that are on pasture, and there are so many pieces of information. One of my favorite movies is Food, Inc. By Michael Pollan. Yeah,
it's disturbing. Whoa.
Yeah, some people watch it and they say, oh, I want to be a vegetarian. Well, you know, we aren't really created to be vegetarians. I think we need to have a plant-based diet. I love what Michael Pollan says, that you need to eat real food, not too much, mostly plants. But don't forsake the animals who are on pasture. That's where we get our fat-soluble vitamins from, the fat. In the 1930s, Weston Price traveled the globe, and his whole purpose was, instead of taking things from the grave to the cradle, instead of taking diseased people and saying, how can we fix them, he said, what would happen if we went out and found people who had no disease? They didn't have arthritis. They didn't have structural abnormalities. They didn't have TB. They were strong. They lived long, healthy lives. They were straight. They weren't crooked. They had no dental disease. And he actually found these little groups of people. And so this was the 1930s, and we didn't have names for a lot of our vitamins, but he called it, I believe, substance P and substance N. It turns out one of them was vitamin D3, and the other one was vitamin K2. Now, we're pretty good about D3. I think if you talk to the average person who's fairly savvy, they're going to tell you that vitamin D3 is important. But what they may not know is if they're not getting enough K2 from pasture butter, where the cow ate the grass, chewed the grass, regurgitated the grass, chewed the grass, then the cow can make the milk, and the milk and the butter and the cheese is full of vitamin K2. So it's really important that your dairy products be from pastured animals, not pasteurized, but pastured on pasture.
Yeah. Great info there. You are so knowledgeable, Pat, about so many things concerning nutrition. But let's go back to the sugar thing. That is what we're talking about here.
Mm-hmm.
Does sugar play a role in, like, emotional challenges and mental disorders?
Absolutely. Now, when we talked earlier about how that insulin and sugar cycle goes up and down, up and down, the organ in the body that's the most responsive to that is the brain. You know, it's been said that the lungs only breathe to feed the brain, the mouth only eats to fuel the brain. So imagine a brain on full fuel. You have lots and lots of energy. I mean, you might be called manic, right? Then the brain runs out of fuel. You have no energy. You don't feel like doing anything. You're a little bit crabby. You might be called depressive. You can follow those high and low cycles in the diet and just track it with somebody who's bipolar. We've seen kids with ADD be able to not have to take medicine if they feed their brain properly. I've had children's teachers call me and say, thank you for whatever you're doing. Because it makes a huge difference in my classroom. I think Gary Null wrote a great book about that called Food, Mood, and Body. It's just phenomenal. It talks about how nourishing your brain makes all the difference. And then Natasha McBride, I think what I got on the K2, I was thinking about Dr. McBride saying that if you eat enough grass-fed butter, you melt your own plaque in your arteries in 6 months. So I wasn't, we weren't too far off topic, but anyway, she also wrote a book called Gut and Psychology Syndrome, where she describes what happens in our guts as we eat these sugars and the grains that break down to sugars really quickly, and they ferment away in our guts and create all this candida, which directly links to behavioral issues, mood disorders. And interestingly enough, once you have that overgrowth in the guts, the growth itself makes you crave more sugar.
Wow. So it really is a self-feeding cycle then. So the book that you're referring to, Pat, you're going to give us, you promised a list of resources. She's going to give that to me in the next day or two. And I'm going to post that. Great. I'm going to post that on the Facebook Beyond Abuse Radio page. So if you want to get, she's got so many resources, and we will be creating links to all of these resources that she's sharing. And you can go on the Facebook Beyond Abuse Radio page in the next couple of days and get a list of all of these things. It's a comment that you made, Pat, when you and I were talking about this show, is that sugar addiction is innate. That was a new thought to me. Would you tell us more about that?
It's, you know, when you think of, just as you were saying in the intro about people who've been abused, relying on substance, when you think of sugar, it's people who are looking for sweetness in their life. And the sweetness is the pancreatic energy, which balances out the bitterness and anger that is the more of the liver energy. And so a lot of people not getting that relationally, they replace that with food. So as and even as children, that's why I say it's innate. We're born with a taste for sugar. Little children have a greater taste for sugar than adults. When they do these tests, when the manufacturers try and find their bliss point, which is an interesting concept, but anyway, when they try and find their bliss point, they have little children do the taste testing, and invariably the children pick the products with 40 or 50% more sugar than the adults do. And if you've ever tasted breast milk, it's very, very sweet. But in the Stone Age, in the early times, we might have found a few wild berries in June, maybe a few tiny apples in the fall. We wouldn't have had all this sugar, but sugar is a building taste. So the taste of sweet, we have an endless taste for it. We can eat it and eat it and eat it and never stop. Whereas bitter, we only can tolerate so much bitter. And in our culture, we have so much sweet that no one can tolerate any bitter. But the taste of bitter is self-limiting because that causes us to cleanse and throw off things and, you know, go into diarrhea and vomiting because it's too bitter, it's too cleansing. But the taste for sweet was something that carried us through the times where there maybe wasn't enough food or we couldn't find food. But when we found that taste of sweet, it was very building to us when we would come out of a lean time or a fasting time.
And so rather than when we eat sweet things, rather than kind of getting to the point where, okay, you know, we've had enough of that, we don't want any more, it's much more common that we just want more and more. And so when we start eating sugar, it opens us up to eating more sugar. And I've noticed that after being off sugar for just 3 days, that my desire for it really wanes. Why is that?
Well, the insulin cycle starts to regulate. So instead of having the sugar come in and then the pancreas has to make the insulin, higher insulin makes the sugar drop farther, which makes the craving stronger. The first 3 days, as you probably have experienced, is a lot like coming off drugs.
It's not fun.
It's not fun. Yeah. You're not happy. I tell parents, you know, when we're working with ADD kids, I say, you know, he's going to be a bear for the next 3 days. If you want it to end after 3 days, don't give in, right? And then otherwise it goes on and on and on. It never ends because you keep giving in, and then they have to start over.
It's
like we call it the sleeping giant. Once the giant is asleep, don't wake up the giant. And it really does seem for many people, one bite wakes up the giant.
Yeah. Well, so you've dealt with this yourself. Tell us your story, Pat.
Well, my story was more an issue with physical pain. And I was diagnosed by several doctors as being disabled. A couple of them were surgeons. I think there were at least two or maybe three surgeons who each had a different area of my body that they were certain needed surgery, and that this would bring me relief. I would literally have to lay on the couch and sleep, set an alarm for 40 minutes, and then get up and move all the pillows and get into a different position because if I slept longer than 40 minutes, I would wake up screaming in pain. I was highly inflamed, and I was pregnant at the time, so I couldn't take any anti-inflammatories. We couldn't do an X-ray. Even my acupuncturist couldn't give me mustard plasters. There was just so much that could not be done. Mm. But they all assured me that it was probably gestational, probably would go away when the baby came, and it didn't. So if you can imagine such a hopeless situation, and then to have it not end when the baby came, and not only did it not end, it went on for 8.5 years. But with that diagnosis, I just went to my knees, and I said, God, am I disabled? And in my spirit, I didn't have the knowledge I have now, but in my spirit, I felt like, no, there is something wrong, but they're not finding it. And so it allowed me to go out and try other things, you know, acupuncture, massage therapy, chiropractic. There were some things I tried that were very helpful. Some things I tried were not helpful. But I did try a lot of things, and not in, and you know, I think sometimes as moms we don't take as good a care of ourselves as we should. But my little boy was 8 years old, and by then, because I had struggled since I was pregnant with him, and he had terrible asthma, and I finally took him to see the nutritionist that I went to, and she said, "What are you feeding this baby?" And, of course, he was eating all his favorite foods, you know, the macaroni and cheese, pizza, cookie, waffle, pancake. He would do the pancake dance when my husband would make the pancakes. And so she told me no sugar, no wheat, no dairy. And he, I thought he was going to starve. He ate nothing for 3 days. And he would throw his on the chair and say, "I hate the dinner." It was a terrible time. So I know what people are up against when they try and break that sugar addiction. So the long story short is I did do it for my child. I'm not sure I would have done it for myself. But after you struggle for 8.5 years, when somebody says, "Well, it's probably this," you at least owe it to yourself to try.
Well, and you went from, you had a business called Patty Cakes, where you made these incredible cakes. I know, because I used to help you eat them sometimes. It was amazing. Yeah. I remember after church, golly, these desserts that you would bring were just incredible. Yeah. And it was really
very
hard
good
not
at
to
it.
Eat them.
And well,
so you
and,
went
and
from
so,
there to, to doing...
To having
to
none.
Getting rid of the sugar.
Yeah, I went right home.
This.
Oh, I do. Mm-hmm. I know. I have people now, and they want to say, "Well, can I just finish up what's in my cupboard?" And I say, "Take the Band-Aid off or take it off slow, you know, fast or slow. It's up to you." But I threw out 3 50-gallon barrels of food, and I actually called some of the girls I was going to bake their wedding cake, and I referred them to a friend of mine. I said, "You know what? I'm done. If I'm killing my child, I'm done. I'm not doing this anymore." And for, I would say, you know, back in those days, it wasn't as easy to be, you know, gluten-free and sugar-free as it is now. So we just had, you know, we had chicken and broccoli. And then now, of course, I've learned to bake all over again and, you know, ferment foods and sprout things and soak things and make things delicious again. So it's taken a while.
Great cookbooks that you sell too. If you have, I don't know if those are available online, but you can give links to us if they are, where people can get those.
Oh, that'd be a great thing to have. Right now, I just have them available in my office.
Okay.
Let me work on that.
Sure. So one of the things I'd like to talk about is we've referenced a little bit to the goal of the food manufacturers and the way that they design and they promote their foods. Are they really thinking about our health when they do these things?
You know, I think that's the problem. We have food manufacturers who don't care about your health, and we have a healthcare system that's ignorant about your food. So the two of them are kind of self-supporting one another. People get nice and sick off the sugary foods, and then they get to take lots and lots of medicine. The thing about it for me, knowing what I know, that the manufacturers do this on purpose. They hire people. They pay them millions of dollars to come in and run these studies and find the bliss point. Now, the bliss point is not where you take a single bite of something and say, "Oh my gosh, that's the best whatever that I've ever had." It's where you take a bite and it leads to another bite and another bite and another bite and another purchase the next time you're at the store, and you're brand specific the next time you're at the store. Curiosity about the bliss point, my friend runs an amino acid clinic up in Sebastopol, and she is great at getting people off their addictions. And so one of the questions she asks is, "What specific food do you crave?" And she says, like, 8 out of 10 people write Snickers bar.
Wow. So they did a really good job finding that bliss point, huh?
They have found the bliss point. So that's the thing. You know, we've all had something where we had a bite and thought, "Oh, this is wonderful," and another bite, and the third bite, and we never wanted it again. Well, they missed it. They didn't find the bliss point. So the food manufacturers really don't care about your health. And to
how
me,
do they
by
target
now,
children?
Oh my goodness, they have everything at the children's eye level, and I think that checkout aisle is really geared toward the kids. First of all, their products are much sweeter than the adult products, because the kids really need that sweetness to build their bodies, which is why the breast milk is so full of sweet. But we've overdone it now. We've gone way too far. The manufacturers are using processed, highly processed foods that break down to sugars instantly. They've got the, you know, the baby mums and what's being marketed to kids is a terrible thing. I remember when Joe, my youngest son, was 9 years old, so by now I was trying to teach him to read labels, and he couldn't pronounce things very well, and so he would always say, can I have this? Can I have this? Can I have this? And it was a little bag of, can we name brand names? I'm going to say they were a little brand of cheese. Cheez-Its. And so I said, well, can you? And so he says, well, it's got hydrogenated. He says, that's bad, huh? And I said, yeah, that's bad. It's got cottonseed oil. And I said, and cotton is clothes, not food. And it's got yellow number 6. And so he knew anything with a color and a number. And so he threw the Cheez-Its on the floor. And he says, when I'm the president, it's going to be illegal to put this stuff in kids' food. And I thought, it's true.
Is he running for president yet?
Yeah, well, I'm super sticker. Go for president. But they do. Everything is colorful and bright, and they have the cartoon characters trying to sell the cereal, and it's all right there at their eye level. And it's they know if they can get these kids hooked, that the kids will influence the mom to spend the money. Same reason that Coke and Pepsi pay for all the scoreboards in the high schools. They're all Coke and Pepsi, because the scoreboards are thousands of dollars, but Coke and Pepsi give them to the school because there is the big scoreboard with Coke or Pepsi around the perimeter.
So talking about Coke and Pepsi, let's talk about soft drinks.
Well, you know, when you have a life-changing experience, it really gives you a chance to interject that into every area of your children's lives. So, same Joe, science project, when he was in the 7th grade, we took 8 chicken bones and we soaked them in different kinds of soda pop. We used Coke and Dr. Pepper and Sprite. We even had a Diet Hansen's, and we had... not a Diet Hansen's, it was a Diet 7-Up, and a Hansen's, thinking that it was the phosphoric acid in the Coke that was destroying the bones. Now, in order to have the science project, you had to have proved that this was a real issue. So we found a Harvard study saying that young girls who drank more than 3 soda pops a week had more bone loss and less calcium deposition than young girls who did not. So he had this, armed with this study, we soaked the bones in all these different soda pops to see which one was the worst. Okay. And they all turned black, and they were rubbery. They were no longer firm bones. But interestingly, the one that was diet was firm bone, but snapped very easily and was completely hollow. That artificial sugar had sucked all the marrow right out of the bone.
Oh, my goodness.
And so we thought it wouldn't happen with the Hansen's, because Hansen's claim to fame was that they did not have phosphoric acid, but they did have corn syrup. So at the end of the project, we realized that the one thing that all those sodas did have in common was corn syrup, that super, super sweet. Why we make all the GMO corn is to make all this corn syrup, and that's what's in the soda pops.
Mm-hmm.
And then the artificial sugars, I think, are just as bad. Dr. Mercola says they're worse, because the tongue tastes the sweet, the pancreas still makes the insulin, and now there's no sugar to push into the cell. And those artificial sugars actually are linked to brain tumors, brain shrinkage, and the fact is that the aspartame and the NutraSweet shuts down the ATP in the body, which is the mechanism by which we take our air and our food and we create energy, and it takes ATP to get rid of toxins. So it literally shuts down the mechanism where we could protect ourselves from getting tumors from those products.
So the answer then to the sugar problem isn't eating the sugar-free stuff. What is the answer?
Well, the answer is, you know, to revisit that, is to feed your brain, to make sure your brain gets enough protein and fat. Don't go out in the wide world and expect other people to know what you know and to feed you the food you need to eat. If you're going to go somewhere, eat before you go. Try and not go shopping on an empty stomach. I mean, that's, you know, we learned that right out of high school just so we could stick to our budget, right?
Mm-hmm.
But
yeah.
But if you go shopping on an empty stomach, all that brightly colored stuff is going to appeal to you as well. And then your brain is going to start craving the thing that's quick energy because it has run out of fuel. But if you will eat, you know, one of my favorite snacks is to take pecans, raw organic pecans, and drag them through the pasture butter. I use a good grass-fed butter, Kerrygold. I love that butter. The flavor is butter pecan, and I'll eat 5 or 6 or 7 pecans dragged through that butter, and I'm good to go. I can go shopping. I can, you know, avoid the candy aisle. It's
That's
amazing
a great
what
idea.
Can happen. Yeah, if you just feed your brain.
So we mess up the neurochemistry of our brain with all of this sugar and all of these carbs. What can we do? Is there a way to actually fix that neurochemistry?
Absolutely. If you look at the neurochemistry is the word we use to describe serotonin, melatonin, epinephrine, norepinephrine, all these brain chemicals, and if you break them down, they're made of amino acids, and amino acids are made when you eat protein. So your brain's neurochemistry is literally created when you eat protein. So the brain loves protein. The brain is made, if you take out all the water, the brain is made of fat. If we can eat enough protein and fat, we can fix the neurochemistry of the brain and then make sure that the gut bacteria is in good working order.
So it's not hopeless. There are things that we can do.
Oh, no, gosh, no. I have seen some desperate situations get completely healed without medication, and then I've seen people who are heavily medicated at least get to reduce the medication so that they're not just a zombie. They're actually able to focus and function and on very little medication.
Mm. Let's talk for a minute about how sugar addictions affect relationships and attachment.
Well, again, any addiction, anything you're addicted to and taking to the nth degree, you're going to be thinking about that before you're thinking about perhaps a loving way of approaching a situation. The sugar can be a go-to for people. You know, it can be an avoidance thing where they don't want to deal with this situation, so they're just going to sit and eat candy. Do you know what I'm saying? Yeah, so it can kind of come between people. But again, it's like I said, it's the socially acceptable addiction because we can eat a bunch of sugar and still drive a car and probably not kill somebody. You know, so probably not. I would think that relationally it would be because we're not the best we can be. Our brain is not fully engaged. And so we might fly off the handle if our blood sugar is too low, or we might fly into a rage when the blood sugar is too high and just not be an appropriate partner for someone.
I experienced that. There were several years ago I noticed that when I would eat sugar that, like, for the next 3 days I would have a lot harder time controlling my own emotions, my emotional responses. And it was a problem. It was an issue. And if you combine that with walking through, you know, the trenches of healing from trauma, where you're dealing with memories and a lot of pain and a lot of relational pain, especially attachment pain is some of the most difficult pain you can go through if you didn't have the proper attachments as children. And then you fuel that with sugar. It can be downright dangerous.
Absolutely.
I also know that when you are looking at attachment, there are five main things that help with attachment. You have eye contact, you have smiles, you have touch and movement, and you have milk and sugar. And as you said, the breast milk is very sweet. So these are actually the things that I believe God wired us for to be able to create healthy attachment to someone. And it's my speculation here, and I'm actually beginning to read things about this. I think it's being proven true that when we have attachment issues, which I think our nation is chock full of, I think our world is chock full of not having completed proper attachments, going to sugar is a very natural thing because sugar is one of the tools. And dairy, how much dairy do we eat? I think eating the sugar and dairy are something that maybe we're unconsciously using to try to make good being arrested in healthy attachments, because that's part of what it takes to attach. And something interesting that Dr. Jim Wilder has said on the show, for those of you who've been listening for a while, one of the things he talked about when he did the show on food addiction is that instead of attaching to our feeder, we attach to the food. That God created us to attach to the person who's feeding us. And if that fails, then it's a very normal thing to transfer that attachment to the food. And sugar is one of those foods that, as a child, we actually need and helps us to create that healthy joy bond. But when we fail in doing that, oftentimes we end up looking to the feelings that the sugar creates is a substitute for those joy bonds.
Yeah. And it is a substitute. It's a hollow substitute. And then,
like
you say, with the dairy, actually wheat and dairy both have a receptor reaction in the brain called a morphine. Like it's an opiate kind of reaction. And so it numbs us out. So people will numb out to pain, just like the heroin addict with the wheat and the sugar in those little Hostess pies. It's a gluteomorphin from the gluten and caseomorphin from the dairy. And so you think of what people's comfort foods are. It's got wheat and dairy, gluteomorphin and caseomorphin. Pizza.
That makes a whole lot of sense.
Mac and cheese.
Nope.
It's all those
so it's kind
comfort
of a setup.
Foods.
It's
yeah,
kind
it's
of
a
setup.
For sure.
We need the attachment. Mm-hmm. We need some amount of sugar. The way that sugar works within our bodies, we very easily crave it. And once we start eating it, we want more of it. How can we break the sugar habit?
And here's the thing. It's not that our bodies need sugar. Our bodies need sweet. So when you break that sugar addiction, you spend 10 weeks having no processed sugar, no processed foods. Just a little wild strawberry tastes incredibly sweet. It bursts
That's
in your
true.
Mouth, and that sweetness goes clear to the top of your head. But when we're just bombarded with all this manufactured processed stuff, our bodies are not wired to take care of that. And then it becomes addiction.
So what should we do? How can we get off the sugar?
You know, one of the things
that'll end craving.
Yeah. Actually, I think it probably takes longer than 3 days to reset the insulin pendulum. It takes 3 days before you're not just thinking about it all the time. But if you would spend at least 2 weeks only on basically meat and vegetables and good fats, you know, butter, coconut oil, avocado, and then after 2 weeks start to bring back in the beans and the legumes and the peas. See how you feel. If it makes you start craving sugar, then you'll have to keep those carbs down too. And then after 2 more weeks, you could add some of the low glycemic fruits, apple, pear, peach, plum, cherry. And then after 2 more weeks, you could add, just mildly add some of the older grains. I'm not a big proponent of using any of the modern grains like corn, wheat, and rice, but I think the older grains like quinoa, millet, amaranth, and buckwheat are much more healthy for us. They have much more protein, and they have much less of a zonulin reaction in the gut, so much less likely to create a candida overload in the guts.
Interesting.
If you can do, yeah, it's what Dr. Mercola called it. Not Mercola. Dr. Rodier called it sweet death, and he actually wrote a book about it. And I think I have that protocol on my website actually. Under that name, sweet death.
What kind of benefits would someone see if they follow that protocol?
Well, you would start to have real energy. You know, it's one of my clients calls it getting her hum back. Got my hum back. Just
so
a little hum.
Maybe you wouldn't have to medicate with caffeine in order
that's
to
correct.
Get the energy that
that's
went
right.
away with all the sugar.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you start to smile again. You stop obsessing about food. You start to relax a little bit more. You start to sleep better.
Mm-hmm.
It's you have a whole lot less inflammation, less body pain, less fuzzy thinking. Yeah, all that cloudy, fuzzy thinking, poor memory, all that stuff goes away.
And Pat, what helps you to stay off sugar the most?
Well, you know, when I first went to Catherine, she told me that she would rather be hungry than eat badly. And I did not really understand that. But I will tell you this. A few months back, I was at a conference all day. And at the end of the conference, I was going right to a friend's house. And I was starving. I hadn't taken enough snack with me. You know, my own mistake. Arrived hungry, and there was Straw Hat Pizza. And I looked in the box, and I honestly thought to myself, I'd rather be hungry. And I thought, wow. So I finally got it. I'd rather be hungry than eat that. So, but what helps me the most is realizing that the food manufacturers who do this to the food intentionally to get you addicted do not care about your health. We're spending lots and lots of money then on that health. So what keeps me on track is knowing that we vote with our dollar. They're going to keep doing it because they're evil and they don't care. They're going to keep doing it as long as we keep buying it. So I don't vote for that. I don't vote for that with my dollars.
And then there are some practical things we can do. Something you've talked about is don't go to the grocery store hungry. Bring a healthy snack with you. Before you go to a party or something like that, or a meeting where you know there's going to be all kinds of junk that's served, to eat something healthy before you leave. Do you have any other tips like that that you could share with us?
Well, the best thing to do is to start every day with some good protein. And it can be bacon, as long as it's, you know, a vegetarian-fed pig and there's no nitrates in the bacon. It has to be good quality food. Bacon and eggs fried in lots of pasture butter. That would be my favorite thing. But start every day. If
now
you
you're making
do
me hungry.
Yeah, you can do avocado with some cottage cheese in it, however you want to do it. But start your day with protein. Protein and fat. Make sure you get plenty of protein and fat. And then every snack, you look at your snacks and say, is there protein and fat? So celery with almond butter, celery with hummus, any, you know, slices of raw sheep cheese is one of my favorite things. So just make sure you get regular protein snacks, and then you're not crashing at the end of the day, because a crashing person is no fun to be around, and that crashing person is going to reach for the fastest fuel, and that's never going to be the best choice.
Okay, so one of the things I'm hearing is to build an awareness of what your body is doing, how your body is responding to different things that you're putting into it. And one of the things that I found was really helpful that I started doing was creating a health journal. And I would track what I was eating each day. I would track any of the supplements I was taking. I would track my exercise. I would track how I slept or didn't. And I would also track my mood. And it was so cool to go back. Actually, it's kind of depressing, but to go back and look at how what I was eating was influencing my body. And it wasn't always a correlation of, oh, well, I ate this today, so I felt this. Sometimes it was I ate this 2 days ago or 3 days ago.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing that I saw from that was that I have this silly genetic bleeding disease and found out that there were really specific foods that were making me bleed. And if I avoided mm-hmm. those foods, my bleeding would almost stop. And so for me, where I had all this very complex health situation, it was just invaluable in being able to become aware of what I was doing and how those things were impacting my health. And so that's something that people could consider doing as well.
Absolutely. Nutrition Journal is highly recommended, and as you say, what you did and how you felt.
Exactly, to correlate. Okay, this is what I'm doing. This is how it's impacting me. This is how I'm feeling. So if I want to feel better, then maybe I should stop doing this. Or if I want to feel better, mm-hmm. then I should eat more of that or do more of that. Because it's so easy to just go on autopilot, and I think as Americans especially, and we've now imported this all over the world, we have such a selection of all this junk food. And when we get hungry, when we start to experience that crash, we just reach for what's there, what's easiest.
Yeah, whatever's
right?
quick.
Is it
whatever's quick,
easy
whatever's convenient.
That's right. And so having some pre-made snacks or having a list,
mm-hmm.
you know, when
mm-hmm.
I get hungry, let's see, I've got these pistachios or I have some carrots and peanut butter, or I have, mm-hmm. you know, here's the list of things that I
mm-hmm.
could go for. Like you talked about your pecans and butter. That sounds really yummy. I'm really getting hungry now. but to have that go-to so that we don't just go back to, oh, well, okay. You know, one of the things that's really hard to do is if not everybody in your family is on the same page and other people are bringing all
mm-hmm.
this junk into your house.
That is super hard.
It is. So if you
have
everyone
you can't
on the
same clean out
your
pantry.
Family, that's
mm-hmm.
right.
Yes.
Or you clean it out
yeah.
and they bring it back in.
Exactly right. Yeah. Because pantry cleaning out is a big step for changing your diet. You know,
yes,
just go through and get rid of everything that's got the yellow number 6 and the red number 40 and yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And then you, and
well,
then when you have,
is,
well, one thing you can do, and this is something I recommend to clients when they have that kind of situation where the partner is not on board. I say you need to go to your partner and say, I need to do this. I am addicted to this food, and so if you must have the food, you leave it in your truck. Do not bring it in the house.
That's
so
great.
Sometimes
yeah.
they do. You know, they have their little stash in their car, but they don't bring it in the house.
Right. Just eat it at work. And when you get home, pretend
yeah.
that you're going to eat
yeah.
it in a healthy way.
Yeah. Don't let me smell it on your breath. Yeah.
Right. Right. Well, it
so
is time to bring in our discussion starter tonight. Her name is Tara Magpusseau, and she is a certified integrative nutrition coach who coaches her clients on clean eating, eliminating junk food from their diets, and living happy lives. She's passionate about nutrition and wellness. She's struggled all her life with food intolerances and finally felt relief when she cleaned up her own diet and eliminating problem foods. She's still on this journey, which I would say all of us are, to optimal wellness, but she always encourages others to do the same. She has a boyfriend who has diabetes and began a path of nutritional wellness so she can prevent others from going through the struggles that she watches him go through. She puts mm-hmm. on wellness events throughout the Western United States to share her successes and encourages others to live a thriving life. And I'm thrilled to welcome Tara to our show tonight. Thanks for joining us, Tara.
Thanks, Lisa.
You are welcome. It's wonderful to have you here. So you've been listening in on to this conversation, and you have some thoughts of your own. Do you have some questions or comments you'd like to share?
I have a couple. First of all, I'm in total alignment with everything Dr. Adams has said, and mm-hmm. I agree with everything. So it's pretty awesome. I did have a couple questions, though, about kind of you know, when you, someone who has diabetes and they go into the doctor and, you know, the doctor recommends, well, what do I do when my sugar gets low? The doctor will recommend, like, drinking a juice or eating candy, but that kind of puts us back in this vicious cycle of eating more bad foods and whatnot, and I don't know what she would recommend to clients who have that issue, too.
That's a good question. What's your thought on that, Pat? Mm-hmm.
Well, I recommend for people with diabetes the same kind of snacks, and the thing is, if you never let the blood sugar go that low, then you don't have to worry about picking up really quickly with the juice. I have a lot of clients who are on injectable insulin who carry a little juice box around in their glucometer, but when we change their diet to eat this way, a good high protein breakfast, protein snacks, that juice is 6 months old. They haven't had to pull it out and use it. I had one situation where I was teaching a class at a doctor's home, and somebody had this exact question. He had diabetes, and he said, Pat, you know how confusing this is when you tell me one thing and the doctor tells me something else. And so I deferred to the doctor whose home I was teaching, and I said, would you like to address this? And he said, well, we doctors aren't trained in what to teach you to brush your teeth with and what to rub in your armpits, and we take the easy way out. And he said, you don't come to us for training. You come to us for a pill or the quick answer, and so that's what we give you. I thought, well, here it is. The doctor says, blood sugar's low, do candy or juice. We say blood sugar's low because you had too many carbohydrates at the last meal, which triggered too much insulin. And or if they're on insulin injection, they took too much insulin for the meal they had. And so it's the same rules. The same rules apply. We still want them to eat a diet that triggers very little insulin, whether they're injecting the insulin or the pancreas is making it.
Right. Definitely.
Mm-hmm.
That makes a lot of sense.
What was that, Nisa?
I just said that makes a lot of sense.
It does. Really, it does. I heard Patricia's comments about Weston A. Price. I did study him a little bit in school, and I am a huge fan of animal fat, and people think I'm crazy when I say eat lard is the best, you know, better than margarine or any alternatives or any oils and whatnot, and I'm a big fan of nitrate-free bacon, you know, the vegetarian bread, and lots of eggs, and it just makes for healthier. I don't starve in between meals. You know, I'm a big fan
Correct.
Of 3 meals a day. And if you're eating the right proteins, you know, you can get you through to the lunch and through to the dinner without having to have those cravings in the middle and between the time.
Yeah. Yeah, it's kind of a joke in our house how much butter and eggs we eat. It's just my husband and I home now. We go through like 6 dozen eggs every other week and a cube of butter a day. And it's just the two of us, you know. So,
right.
Yeah. I'm right there with you. And we also do the organ meats and the bone broths. I think that we miss out on a lot of that. A lot of people who do eat meat only eat the flesh, but they don't use the bones and the skin to make their broth, and they don't eat the organ meats. And we're missing out on a huge amount of nutrition by skipping those parts.
What about
we
liver?
I remember
growing up on liver, and my parents, you know, liver was supposed to be great for you, and yet now I think about liver, that's the place where all the toxins are kept. Is it good or not to eat liver?
Well, the liver doesn't store toxin. The liver converts it and cleanses the blood. The liver protects the blood, but it doesn't store the toxin. And again, if you look at it, here's a fun thing to do. You know, go buy some liver at, you know, a store that doesn't care where they get it. Go buy some liver that's organic, and then go buy some liver that's pasture raised. And you'll see the first one is like a nondescript kind of grayish mass. The second one that's at least organic is still kind of grayish, but it's more defined. And then the one that is pasture raised is red. It's got a texture like beef. It's unbelievable. It's unbelievable the difference if you'll just go look at those three kinds of animal livers, and then you decide which one you think you'd like to have.
Okay. Tara, what were you saying? You had a question or comment you were throwing in.
Well, notice I would read a lot of articles definitely on my Facebook feeds and people I'm following on Twitter and nutrition and whatnot. And bone broth is becoming this crazy trend. You can go get different flavors of bone broth at different restaurants. You can definitely make it in your home super easy, which is leftovers from a previous dinner. But it's just becoming this well-known thing that everyone's kind of jumping on and noticing the great benefits of it.
Yeah. There's one book of a guy who cured himself of AIDS in his kitchen by doing the bone broths, which is,
wow,
that is wonderful. And
wow,
then the difference in doing your organic bones with, you know, glugging in the raw apple cider vinegar and then cooking it down for 30 hours and what you buy in a box at the store is night and day. Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah, I bet.
Well, so both of you ladies have knowledge and experience on dealing with food, not just as something to satiate our taste buds or our appetite, but looking at food as medicine. What would you guys like to say about that?
Well, Hippocrates said, "Let your food be thy medicine and thy medicine be thy food." And he's the father of naturopaths and allopaths. He was, at some point we split off and naturopaths said, you know what, the body can heal. And allopaths says, no, we need intervention. But the father of all medicine said, let your food be your medicine and your medicine be your food. And the Bible says, let the herbs of the field be your necessary food. That's what I have to say about that.
How can we look
at
food as medicine? Go ahead, Tara.
Well, you know, as she said, and as I like to tell people, whether they're, you know, believe in God or a creator or whatnot, we used to say this thing in elementary school where there's a cure for everything in the rainforest. And I truly believe that everything that's put on this earth, I'm a big fan of minerals and vitamins, and there's a lot of plant sources and animal sources that we can get all this nutrition from and can heal ourselves better than any medicine that can mask it.
Mm-hmm. Correct.
So if we start looking at foods as something that can give us life or take away our life, we might make some different choices.
That's exactly right.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And that's part of what keeps you on track, because everyone's motivation is high when they first make changes. The motivation is real high, and then it kind of wanes. And what I find is that people come, and a lot of times people don't really want to get well. They just want relief of symptom. They get relief of symptom, and then they slip off, and then they go, oh, and I ate pizza and beer, and then I got this bellyache, and I'm like, well, why did you do that? You know. So the motivation doesn't stay high once the symptom is gone. So if you can realize that you know, when someone says to you when you're 60 that you can, you know, get up and do this exercise every day and extend your life 7 years, that might not mean a whole lot to you. But when you're 72 and you could have made it to 80, that's when it makes a difference.
Mm-hmm.
But it's something that you always have to keep in the forefront of your mind, that what you do matters.
Yeah. And that's part of just learning to live in a mindful sort of way, which I think we're forgetting how to do more and more. I think it's so easy to just be plugged into our electronics and to go along with whatever everybody else is doing or eating or serving, or and to not make the connection between how our actions and our choices are affecting not just our bodies, our minds, our spirits, our relationships, everything. It's like we're living this disconnected life. We spend our calories and our money and our time and our energy in ways where we're just oblivious to the results of those choices.
Yeah. Yeah.
Exactly.
Well, and it really is time to wake up. You know, it's time to wake up and smell those green coffee beans.
So what is it that helps people wake up? What's finally kind of the straw that breaks the camel's back for most people?
Well, in my case, what I see a lot is that it's a diagnosis that they don't want. They either have diabetes or pre-diabetes, or they have cancer, or they have arthritis, or they have an autoimmune disorder, or they've exhausted every other possibility before they'll finally change their diet. It's unfortunate that it's that way, but I don't see very many people come in who say, "Oh yeah, I'm pretty healthy. I just want to eat better." I don't get to see it.
Well, it is pretty countercultural, and it takes a lot of motivation to do it. And so I would say, I know with my very complex set of health issues that I deal with, it took a lot to get me to be willing to make those changes, because it's hard to do. All three of us have been there, done that. We know that. It's not like we're sitting here saying, oh, yeah, it's going to be a walk in the park. It's a picnic. But once you get to the other side of the initial pain of making those changes, you'll find that it is so well worth expending the energy and learning the new habits and training yourself and breaking the addiction to be able to get to the health.
Exactly.
Yeah,
right.
That's what we talked about the other day. We're talking about how when you start to get healthier and you feel better, you feel more amazing, and you just want to feel more well. It's a good feeling, and a lot of people don't get that feeling. But once you've kind of broken in through the surface of that wellness, you can kind of feel your health getting better, and you just want that more and more.
Mm-hmm. And then that's self-motivating.
Right. If you don't know what healthy feels like, you don't know what you're missing. But once you begin to experience it, that fuels the fire for, maybe I do have some power over changing things. I don't know if, Pat, this is something you told me. I remember learning that people going into medical school, 95% of them believed that what you ate and what you put into your body impacted your health. And that coming out of medical school, only 5% of them still believed that that was true.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Well, there's a lot written about that, and it's apparently something that's been done to our doctors on purpose, that they've been trained very heavily in procedure and medication, and their training in herbalism and natural remedies has diminished so that they can sell more pharmaceuticals. And that whole shift in the medical schools was done when Rockefeller funded the first pharmacy. And so, you can't be upset that doctors aren't aware of this knowledge, and then this knowledge is handed on person to person. We're the keepers of the knowledge, and so some people have shown a great amount of proficiency, and other people have no proficiency at all. And so, doctors are scientists. They're not going to say, "Oh my gosh, this thing that you wave over your head is not going to help you." It's really hard for them, I think, and that was done to them on purpose. I've had so many doctors who've kind of come to the dark side who've shared that with me, that they were so disappointed when they got all the way through medical school and only had a finite set of tools with which to help people.
Which speaks to me of the need for discernment, to be able to, as well as learning what is happening to our bodies as a result of what we're doing to them, to also be aware of, any doctor, all doctors are people. And doctors and all of us are a result also of our own experience and of our training. And so not every doctor is going to be a good doctor. Not every nutritionist is going to be equal to other nutritionists. And not everything that there's no equation where someone can have the answer that fits everyone. There's no one size fits all, though there are some general things that we can say about how certain things are going to affect most bodies. We need to learn to just be aware of ourselves and of the people that we're going to for help. We wouldn't go to... I'm sorry, go ahead, Pat.
I was going to say, and don't be afraid to interview the doctor. Let the doctor know that you're interested in taking charge of your own health. And is he comfortable or is she comfortable with you doing that? Some doctors are very excited when you're willing to take some responsibility for your own health, and other doctors are actually offended. So the difference in what we do and what they do is we give you charge of your health. We say, if you will do this, you will feel better. And when you go to the doctor, you're basically giving them charge of your health. But people do forget that you hire your doctor, and you are allowed to say, nope, I don't want to do that. If you are not willing to work with me in this regard, do you have a referral for someone who is? You know, so
so we have options.
You have options.
You
definitely do.
Is there really hope for us to change our sugar ways and live healthy lives?
Absolutely. And here's the deal. If you don't have any big health issues, you can do well 85% of the time, and you can slide a little bit, and your health will forgive you. When you have a brain tumor, you don't get that 15%. You have to behave. So if you early on will take the reins and say, I don't want to go down that path. I don't want to wait till I have a horrible diagnosis. I want to take the reins of my life now, and then, you know, do well most of the time, your body will forgive you a 10% fudge.
Mm-hmm. Right. Tara, do you have any last thoughts?
Yes, I mean, I agree with her. I kind of follow this kind of 80-20 because I travel a lot and do a lot of events. I pretty much shop well when I'm at home, shop for groceries, but I don't, you know, I'm not hard on myself when I go out and eat with friends or family, and so I definitely stay away from gluten because it will make me sick, but a little sugar, you know, I don't want to be hard on myself for eating a cupcake, a gluten-free cupcake at a party or whatnot, and I totally agree with that. And it's nice to not have to think about it all the time because it then overpowers you to always try to be healthy. There's a new term, orthorexia, where you're so much consumed by eating healthy all the time, it's becoming an eating disorder.
Well, one thing that we know for sure, and that is that we are not alone on this journey. The bottom line is that sugar is addictive, and addiction sucks. And addiction takes us places we never intended to go. And it takes community to be able to overcome them and to heal. It takes community to heal from trauma. Just know that whether you're already on a healing journey or you're just beginning in the commitment to walk this path, where maybe you're deciding, I need to kind of go through my pantry and throw out the sugar, or maybe I need to look at going off gluten and dairy, or maybe I just need to be around people who understand these things and be able to have some support, you are in good company. There are so many people who are doing the hard work that you're embarking on now, and there are so many resources to help you along the way. In fact, we said that Pat's going to be sending us a bunch of links and resources you can help, that can help you, to encourage you, to educate yourself. There's so much now that we know that you can begin educating yourself and understand what are the effects of the things that you're eating and doing. And I just want to encourage you to find companions to share with and to say yes to that process of being stretched and growing into new areas of risk and new areas of trust and even new areas of faith. We have some amazing things that are going to be coming up in the next few months on our show. In March, Daryl Brazell is going to be speaking up for wives who are suffering trauma from their husband's sexually addictive behaviors. He has done a video that is available on YouTube. I don't know how many hits it's had, but many, 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 where he actually apologizes to women for the husband's actions connected to sexual addiction that have deeply, deeply wounded them. And one of the things we're going to be talking about on that show, too, is how women often repeat the trauma of their childhood by marrying men who continue to abuse them sexually through their pornography or distorted pressures and demands. And so if you know of anyone who is dealing with a loved one who has a sexual addiction, is dealing with pornography, we're going to be talking very frankly about the bad and the ugly, because there just isn't any much good to have said there. But then Daryl is going to be doing some incredible good as he informs us about the impact of those behaviors and about his heart for those women who are suffering in the midst of that. We also have a new series coming up on spiritual tools for trauma recovery, and I am really excited to be doing this because these spiritual tools have had tremendous impact in my life and my own healing journey. We're going to be talking about things like centering prayer and Lectio Divina, spiritual direction, the spiritual exercises of Ignatius. Also, we're going to be talking about the great question that I think sooner or later we all come to, and that was, where was God when the abuse happened? And then we're going to be talking about learning how to suffer well. And I can't wait to share with you some of the things that I'm learning right now in some new training about the mechanics of the brain and how we either become equipped or lose out on the ability to be able to work through our suffering without being traumatized. Wouldn't that be great to be able to experience things that are difficult and know how to actually quickly reconnect ourselves to a place of joy and peace? And so that's going to be some good, good stuff coming up. To learn more about trauma recovery and receive the support and encouragement and inspiration that you would like, you can join my email list. You can go to my website, which is www.misacoach.com. You can also send me an email to inspire@misacoach.com, and I encourage you to contact me if you have ideas for the radio show, any thoughts or questions. And there's also the Facebook page of Beyond Abuse Radio that I would love to hear from you on. I just thank you, ladies, for this time together tonight. I so appreciate your willingness to be here, to share your own journeys, your heart, your work. You're just amazing.
Thank you, Lisa.
You guys are awesome. You keep up the good work. I know that you're both touching other people's lives with the work that you're doing, and just wish you just continued health and success in your journeys, in pursuing better health in your own lives and helping other people to have the same. I hope that you all have been as inspired tonight as I have by today's talk on breaking the sugar habit, walking through the pain of healing from addiction, of trauma healing. It's a challenge, but the truth is, beloved, there is so much life to be had on the other end. And don't ever forget that you're not alone, because we can't do this by ourselves. Thanks for joining me on this amazing journey of healing, and I hope that you make the decision to give yourself the time and the energy you need in order to do this important work in your life. And whether that's going to the cupboard now and getting rid of that sugar, or that's reading some of the books that are available, or that's calling someone to get help, a wellness coach, a naturopath, a spiritual director or life coach to help you to make some of those hard decisions and to support you in that process. I just want to encourage you to do that, and also to be able to embrace all of your precious self and love, because you are worth it. You're worth taking care of. You're worth spending some time and money on. You're worth being able to discipline yourself to be able to walk into the physical health, the emotional health, the spiritual health, to be able to do all of the hard work to heal so that you can learn how to thrive and have healthy and mature relationships and build the community that you so badly desire. I hope you are able to embrace all of your precious self and love. And I hope that you will also choose to let other people enter into that and to love and to know you too, because the truth is, dear ones, you are truly beautiful. We'll talk again soon.